current global COVID-19 crisis is having a huge impact on the defence sector, which is demonstrating a high level of resilience and innovation in continuing to keep the nation protected in these difficult times. Whilst mission-critical activities and budgets will be secure in the short term, the global trends in maximising the efficiency of defence procurement spending and the shifting sands of strategic spending priorities means that the sector needs to be continuously focused on remaining flexible and adaptable. I'm Andrew, and I'll be hosting our podcast today, which intends to explore some of the challenges and the topics shaping the future of Defence Air today. On today's podcast, I'm joined by Richard Lees, Atkins Chief Engineer, James Benfield, our Client Manager for Defence Air Industry, and Luca Leone, Head of Programme at Aralis. It's often considered that military technologies generate spin-off applications in the civil space. Do you have any thoughts on where military platforms might benefit from current trends in the civil space?
In our more interconnected world, I think technology moves from sector to sector and each sector feeds off another. So I agree that a lot of technology has trickled down from defence into all sorts of domestic and industrial processes and appliances over time. Nowadays, automotive perhaps leads some of the technology adoption. The things that might creep back from civil into the defence side might include modular build. I don't really know who's leading the digital drive at the moment, but certainly there's a lot going on in the civil sector, in the automotive sector, that, from my perspective, will help us in the defence sector.
I think there's a lot of cross-pollination from different industries. Certainly one of the effectively new industries on the horizon is the urban mobility sector. That's pulling in technologies from the electric vehicle market in terms of automotive. Some of the technologies they're developing in that market have a direct relevance into defence. So things like last mile resupply, but also the greater use of electrification within an aircraft and the use of data and information flowing into that aircraft are just as relevant to the larger platforms. And certainly when you start looking towards Tempest and things like that, there's lots of innovative sort of enabling technologies that are being developed in the new section of civil aerospace, if that's what you want to call it, that will be really key to those new military platforms coming soon.
Great, thanks, Luca. And James?
I think it's the digitalisation and the way that data is used or will be used in the future, which comes from, as people have mentioned, different markets and different areas, but also how that data is used and how it's used to support operability and maintain availability of aircraft in the future. Is certainly going to play a significant part in how those aircraft are designed and how the systems and the system of systems on those aircraft are implemented in the future. And I think the cybersecurity and those elements of those platforms will be key going forward in the development of military aircraft.
It's a huge motivator in the civil aerospace sector, but how important do you think sustainability is in the defence air domain?
I think it's something that's gaining rapid traction, and certainly this year the new Chief of Defence Logistics Staff, Lieutenant General Richard Wardlaw, has come into post, and we have General Nuji as well, who have identified sustainability as one of their key metrics and something they're investing heavily in, and they're targeting net zero 50 as their key target for the Ministry of Defence. The Ministry of Defence is the biggest emitter of CO2 across government. I think it's about 50% of all government emissions come from the MOD. The challenge the MOD faces is the platforms they're acquiring, things like the Queen Elizabeth carriers, are in service for decades often. And obviously switching power plants and things like that are very expensive things to do. So it's always a tough play between, delivering that effect and that capability, but also, protecting the homeland. It comes in many forms, and climate change is obviously one of the biggest risks and one of the biggest dangers that we face at the moment. So those two things come hand in hand.
The whole through life development and supportability is being thought of more these days than it was historically. So prior in the past, platforms have been developed merely looking at the product, and then the through-life supportability was an addition afterwards. And to create a sustainable platform going forward, or to increase sustainability, we're seeing that through our asset management work, that through-life supportability element is coming to the fore. So that's not only in determining the correct supply chain management strategy, but also when you look at obsolescence, with the way that we're looking at digitalization and electrification, the term obsolescence will become even more paramount as we go forward. So yes, I think sustainability isn't just the change or development of different fuels or technologies. It's about how we manage those technologies going forward and how we manage the supply chain and make it as efficient and as lean as possible.
My observation is that the MOD recognise the societal pressure for them to reduce their footprint, be that carbon, be that noise, in all domains, land, sea and air, that on the battlefield, getting fuel out to the soldiers is incredibly expensive. So too for forward bases that have air support. The need to protect the environment, to respond to the societal pressure, is ever increasing, both in budget terms and in terms of support of what the government get the forces to do for us.
Which technologies do you think will have the biggest impact on defence aircraft design in the next decade?
Going forward, and you can see it with some of the programmes that are engaged in the UK at the moment and across the world, that it isn't looking at the aircraft. They're not designing the aircraft. It's looking at the technology and how that will be integrated potentially onto an aircraft and integrated with other technology in the future. That's kind of what we're seeing, isn't it? No one's out there sketching up the full airframe for an aircraft. They're sketching up all the different elements that need to integrate and work with each other on that aircraft in the future, and potentially what the future looks like, because everyone's trying to guess what the need will be and what the threats will be in the future, which is ever changing day by day. So it's understanding what those threats are and understanding how you take that information and what you do with it, and then how you fit that to the whatever platform it's going to be in the future.
Rich?
I think we're going to see some cross-pollination of other sectors. So looking at even the toy sector of drones and swarming drones that we see at New Year celebrations in the Far East, that it's very impressive how you can get those drones to interconnect and to fly together, and I think we are going to see that sort of thing crossing over into the defence sector. When it comes to the manned and unmanned conversation of, you know, will man still be on the aircraft, or will the aircraft become almost like a drone? But ultimately, autonomy in that sector will be limited by, I believe, the final decision for lethal action. That we'll see autonomy for swarming aircraft or drones, loyal wingman, but I don't think we'll ever allow the aircraft to make the decision for the strike. I think that's got to remain with a human for accountability. So there's some really interesting interconnectedness that we're going to see more of in the defence that we've already seen in the toy sector and the gaming sector.
But I think there's so many exciting technologies that are being developed and worked on at the moment. And I don't think there's any one specific technology that will absolutely change the world. You know, you look back to things like the jet engine and the sort of changes that made. I'm not sure we're on the verge of one particular technology that will change everything. But I think what will change everything is the combination of lots of different technologies. I think on the subject of autonomy, people often view autonomy as if it's a binary choice. You know, you either have a pilot or you don't. I think autonomy, certainly over the next 10, 20 years, is going to be much more about taking the pilot out of just flying the aircraft to become more of a mission manager. And I know people talk about this in F-35 already, and I think that will become more and more important. But using things like autonomy underpinned by more artificial intelligence and more data analytics, and pulling the various sensors and things like that from around the battlefield in to educate and inform the pilot. And certainly you can see that in automotive at the moment. So, you know, my car now has a system where I can take my hands off the wheel and it starts to do the driving for me. And I think, you know, obviously aircraft have had those sorts of basic technologies for a while now, but that will become much more integrated into the mission management and that side of things.
On the point of technologies, I personally think, and we're seeing it with our clients in Atkins at the moment, that one of the biggest areas which is going to grow is around data and the use of data. So when you think of autonomous aircraft, you think of the loyal wingman projects that some companies are developing. All the interconnectivity between these technologies requires a huge amount of data and data processing. So I think the analysis of that data and how it's used and how you define the key trends, how an autonomous aircraft defines and understands its environment and its threats, how it transmits that data to satellites, so space is a key element, and how it divulges and transfers that information to people is going to be the biggest thing, because tied into that is obviously the vulnerability, and we're seeing it in our cyber vulnerability investigations, that this is a key area. So while the technology is developed for autonomy, and all this data is created, we need to make sure it's safe and it can't be attacked, and we need to understand who and what those threat actors are. So for me, it's the kind of system of systems, and how that data that is transmitted between those systems and how it's transmitted to the ground is probably one of the biggest areas and the biggest changes over the existing kind of fast jet arena in the future.
I think one of the other interesting areas which is often talked about is the third offset strategy, and that's how does NATO and its allies maintain a combat edge over adversaries. And I think it's a bit of a tiptoe to trying to walk a thin line, maybe is a better phrase, but using exquisite platforms, so, you know, very expensive and very highly engineered platforms, but still maintaining a combat mass. So trying to find the right ratio of expendable or cheaper assets along with those exquisite platforms will be a key decision to be made by the various capability branches across the West in the coming years. And there's some really interesting sort of thoughts and concepts of operations and that sort of thing around this area, which I think will become more and more important over the next few years.
I think Aerolis is trying to strike an interesting family concept there of the basic and the advanced trainers, but also to be thinking ahead to the derivatives. So rather than to have a single magic bullet, exquisite solution to be able to support that exquisite solution, to be able to train people to operate that exquisite solution, but also to be able to offer the companion aircraft, the aggressor, all these other points of the family that are needed.
Absolutely. You can draw some very interesting lessons from the United States, but looking at things like their OAX program, where they're looking at close air support using much cheaper assets. So rather than having an F-35 loitering on station with a high cost per flying hour, you can use much cheaper platforms and some still relatively clever weapons technology, but deployed on that cheaper platform to deliver the effect at a much reduced cost. So still retaining those exquisite technologies for when they're required, but just not utilising them in every single situation.
Right. And I think something else that Aerolis is approaching very well is this notion of a training ecosystem. So it isn't just the plane, it's the whole training syllabus. It's the whole bit from a cadet through to a frontline pilot. What is that syllabus? How do we build the experience? How do we use synthetics and data to support that pilot in his or her development and career, so that we get the right solution for the Air Force that we're supporting? So it really is about that holistic approach.
We've mentioned loyal wingman, we've mentioned kind of less expensive forms of military aircraft to support the exquisite platforms. One of the key technologies that you see written in the press, etc., is the ability to repair or build or manufacture certain elements of these systems in the field. So it could be in the future that 3D printing or additive layer manufacturing features in the kind of in-field operability of these technologies. So I think also that's a key technology which could drive forward in the future.
We've mentioned a few times now, we've touched slightly on what you're looking to do at Euralis. Euralis are developing a new family of aircraft to meet future defence training needs from scratch. What are the most challenging aspects of designing an aircraft for this domain?
So, yes, as you rightly say, so Euralis is developing an entirely new aircraft. I think one thing that's important to bear in mind is we see the aircraft very much as a vehicle, and I mean that in the other sense. Obviously, it is a vehicle, but it's a way of getting a pilot up there and in immersing him or her in the environment. Throwing those challenges at them and testing what they're feeling. But incorporating that with the various other technologies. So one thing we've mentioned already, but looking at ground-based training environments, looking at how you do as much training on the ground as possible to save the time in the air. There's a whole host of interconnected aspects to training now. Many years ago it was just here's the keys to the plane, go off and fly it. It's much more complicated than that now. And certainly the pilots of tomorrow will be managers of various assets while they're flying, rather than just learning to fly. So we're trying to incorporate all of that, all of those different technologies and requirements into the design of this ecosystem. I think one of the biggest challenges is obviously designing an aircraft that that will be relevant when it's launched, in the next few years, but will still be relevant in the next 20, 30, 40 years and potentially beyond that. So what we don't want to do is design an aircraft that is a fixed point. So we use the term evergreen. It can be updated and refreshed throughout its life cycle without having to redesign the platform. So, when a new technology in avionics comes out, we can retrofit that technology into the aircraft and away we go. And the aircraft is then, just as relevant as it is now. So, we envisage pilots training on an Euralis aircraft and going to an F-16, but equally training on that aircraft and going on to fly the Tempest aircraft. So it's a real challenge to incorporate all those requirements and distill them down into one common platform.
So our aspiration at Euralis is to develop a family concept, not just the two immediate trainers of the basic and the advanced trainer, but the platform onto which different systems can be fitted for different purposes, and that, for example, the aggressor training could be adapted in a straightforward fashion from the original aircraft, because the original aircraft is being contemplated with that development roadmap in place, that as we establish the requirements, working with the different Air Force needs, because of course there are different departments in the Air Force having different thoughts on what they need. Our job is to assimilate all those requirements, distill them down into the key design drivers, so that we can look at concepts that support them and put them on our roadmap for eventual development of the family of aircraft.
One of the areas that we're seeing is, and I think it's been touched on, is that clients don't just want to buy just the aircraft. Certainly in the export market, where certain customers may not have a truly native air force, they are looking for that end-to-end offering. So they are looking for someone or a company to come in and not only provide them with their trainer aircraft, but also to provide them with all of the facilities and the elements that make up those facilities to get them to a point where they can have fully trained pilots ready to go and the aircraft maintained for them to fly. So I think probably that is one of the biggest challenges, is trying to package that up and offer something that's quite new and quite dynamic, where it's not just the aircraft, but it's also the training academy. It's the runway, it's the planning, the infrastructure that goes around it. It's the planning of the training of staff. And the asset management that goes with it, and then onwards to the supportability regarding the maintenance, etc. So that's kind of, from my point of view, where I'm seeing quite a big pull in certain areas, is that whole end-to-end delivery of not only the purchase of the aircraft, but the whole environment in which that sits through its life.
COVID-19 has seen our established ways of working change at a pace very few expected. Have there been any particular aspects of how the defence community has responded that you think would be worth building on or hanging on to once the current crisis has passed? James?
Well, here at Atkins, we've had over 30,000 people working remotely, both on restricted platforms and unrestricted platforms. One of the key things I've seen is that certainly some defence clients maybe weren't up to speed with remote working, and it's excellent to see how they've adapted. I think one of the things I'd like to see going forward, and I've seen with the remote working element, and as much as we need to come together to collaborate for meetings, etc., is I think there's efficiencies to be had from remote working, and the lack of a need to drive for several hours to be somewhere, to attend a meeting just to be at the meeting, for example. We've had some good experience with clients while we've been in lockdown, where we've actually onboarded people and we've onboarded new programs and projects, and we've actually helped our clients develop new ways of working and new ways of actually engaging with us and setting up those programs. So I think that, yeah, I think there's ways in which the defence community can change. I think they have been changing, and I think in some ways it's probably for the better in terms of that remote working and kind of making it more lean, more effective.
I think these new ways of working have posed challenges to all sorts of businesses in all sorts of different ways, and Aralis is certainly one of those. An organization in growth, we're taking people on and recruiting people entirely virtually, which is certainly something new for me. We've never done before. We have people around the world that we're bringing on and engaging in the program without ever meeting them, and that's interesting and exciting. I think what we're trying to do is make sure that the lessons we're learning and the technologies we're using are not just a temporary fix, but are something we look to use as much as possible as things start to get back to normal again, and certainly utilizing the best in class skills wherever they are in the world can only be a benefit to us, rather than just whoever it is that's just around the corner sort of thing. So making the most of that, those distributed teams. Obviously there's technology challenges in that, and we're investing heavily in how we engage and run teams remotely and wherever those teams may be, and it's a learning curve, but we're not the only ones going through it, I suppose.
And I wonder if from an engineering perspective, anyone's got any particular thoughts on, we've got the distributed and remote teams element and all the communications that go alongside that, but have any of you come across any particularly great practices or ways of working that have enabled engineering to continue specifically, I guess? Any thoughts we want to add there?
From my own point of view, it's very interesting to see how both partners were engaged with and clients were engaged with came together to try and develop solutions to some of the key challenges that government were putting out. So Atkins was involved in several schemes along with some of the big players in the defence industry, and it was very, very good to see how quickly they came together and to try to answer some of those challenges, and some of them did answer some of those challenges. So to me, it was very interesting because it's quite a big question, isn't it, in terms of the impact defence has on society. And I think that's a very big one, because the mobilisation and how quickly those companies pivoted to respond was really stellar.
Well, they say that necessity is the mother of invention, don't they? There are other versions of that, I'm sure. But the necessity to maintain our defence, our ability as a country, as our professional delivery as businesses, meant that we had to innovate. And to an extent, we'll find that some of the space that was created there will bring new products, new ways of working, new mindsets perhaps for some people who are used to waiting in particular ways for the job to turn up or whatever. Everybody's had to work out, well, who can help me get this done, and think through it in a slightly different way. And that's that need to wake up and find another way is a good thing to have in any business. It's just unfortunate that there was so much of it all at once.
Thank you, Rich, James and Luca, for joining us today to discuss some of the topics that are shaping the future of defence. We've covered a lot of ground, and your insights have been really useful, so thank you. And thanks also to everybody for listening.